Visible is a wireless carrier that is not invisible. It is pretty clear from the name, actually, radio waves are invisible. And I can say this with authority as a licensed amateur radio operator. That being said, Visible won't be giving you the power to see light outside the visible spectrum. It's actually way better because having that ability would make getting around very difficult and distracting. What you do get with Visible is unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. You get one line of wireless, just $25 a month, which is great in these times of economic uncertainty. That is one line for $25, taxes and fees included. So whatever you're doing at this moment, please stop. Switch immediately. Now, monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Wir gerne sehen, was ist los? It's deinen Freundo, Seth. I'm learning German. Yeah, in case you didn't know what that was. That is me trying to impress you with the little German that I know. Right now, I am actually learning German. I took it in high school. I goofed off the entire time. I did some other language learning apps. They taught me things like where the taxi stand is and how to find a bus, but not a lot of conversational German. Thankfully, that's what Babbel is all about. Babbel teaches you language conversationally, which, let's face it, that is what you want to know anyway. I don't know. When I was in school, you learned like how to count. You learned like the colors. You learned the shapes. Those are all important things, but they don't help you when you're in like Cologne, Germany with Ein Nierenstein, which, by the way, is German for kidney stone. An experience I can unfortunately speak personally to, but I've been using Babbel to learn to speak German again, better than I have before. I actually really like it because it is conversational. It's a little bit more relaxed. One of the things that it does that I really like is it'll sometimes show you what the literal English translation is. And I don't know why, but I find that very helpful in sort of understanding the structure, the grammar of a language and sort of putting myself into that mind space. Since I'm only in Germany for Gamescom, which is like a week, week and a half, I'm not immersed in the German language. I'm not immersed in German culture. So what I do is the second best thing. I'm taking Babbel. Hopefully this year when I go to Germany, I'll be able to impress all the Germans with how much German I know from learning through Babbel. The app has pronunciation recognition, so you'll be able to learn how to speak better with your accent, how to actually properly pronounce the words. That way you won't get made fun of by a group of older German men because you said apple strudel and not Apfelstrudel. No, it's really cool. I'm going to say right now there is a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now you can get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, because you guys are the best ones, by the way, at babbel.com/realm. Get 60% off at babbel.com/realm. That is spelled babbel.com/realm. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Oh, I didn't see you there. Hi, Super Ninfriendos. Welcome to Nintendo Voice Chat, episode 620. I am your host, Seth Macy. Joining us this week in the pear chair, Mitchell Salzman.
Ooh, the pear chair. Yeah. I feel so honored.
Industry legend, Kat Bailey.
Hello from the cat chair.
The cat chair. And from the Tom stool, Tom Marks.
No, I want to imagine that I'm sitting in that, like, the froggy chair from Animal Crossing.
That is the official, what the fourth chair is, the rotating
it's the froggy chair.
Yeah, so yeah. Actually, you are correct with
there
that.
There we go,
so
nailed it.
From the froggy chair, it's more of a dais, actually. It's a high. Tom Marks, thank you for joining us. Wow, nothing happened this week. Oh, except yesterday and the day before. But let's talk. First of all, we have Mitchell on the show specifically for this subject and his expertise in not only the gameplay, but the lore of Bayonetta 3. Yeah, we have an official release date coming out October 28th, 2022. That is 17 days after my birthday. So I'll be getting myself a late birthday present. Just kidding. I'm an adult. I can buy things whenever I want to. It's going to have a naive angel mode, which is a toggle. So if you don't want to see like boobies and pornography, you can just turn it off. If you don't, you know, if you're playing your Switch on a bus or at a, I don't know, a choir event of some sort, at church, if you're playing Bayonetta at church, you can play it with a naive angel mode. And that's where she keeps her clothes on. Wait, while she...
Bayonetta 3 at church is actually thematically appropriate, I'll have to say.
That is true. I don't know if the rest of the congregation would be too thrilled about it, but yes, Mitchell, you're going to say.
I was going to say, I actually saw like what I thought was a good justification for it also in the comments of one of the videos, but you know, it's something that streamers can also use because when they play they get content flagged all
that
the time.
That is true.
For nudity and sexual situations. So, you know, it could be a good thing for YouTubers or streamers to, you know, just turn on so that they don't have to deal with that stuff.
Yeah, I hadn't actually considered that. That is a very good point. And, you know, this is definitely a streamable game. Bayonetta 2 is one of my favorite Switch and one of my favorite Wii U games as well. And I own both copies. Mitchell, we were talking a little bit in the Nintendo Voice Chat secret Slack channel that's not actually that secret. And Tom and I were both a little confused by the story. that is to say, even though I've played Bayonetta 2, I don't actually know what's going on. And then you swept in. Could you give us a little bit of an update as to what is actually going on in Bayonetta for maybe those who have just a little bit of knowledge that Bayonetta even exists?
It's hard to, like, you know, really put anything concrete together because this is a trailer that's so, you know, it's just a bunch of scenes that are kind of out of context. I think the main thought of people is that the Bayonetta that we're seeing that we get to control is potentially going to be the grown-up version of Cereza from Bayonetta 1. Cereza and Bayonetta are obviously the same person, but in Bayonetta 1, you basically run into a kid version of Cereza who was plucked from the past. And, you know, you basically go through that whole game with her as Bayonetta, and then she gets, at the end of the game, she gets put back into her actual timeline. And I think the thought is that in Bayonetta 3, we're going to be playing as the grown-up version of Cereza from Bayonetta 1. And I think the big clue is her hairstyle, which is very similar to how Cereza had her hair in the first game.
Can I just stop you right there? I want to give credit where credit is due. Casey DeFreitas came on the show months ago when there was a trailer and explained why she thought Bayonetta's makeup and hair looked different. And she said exactly what you are saying now, but this was like months ago. And it was based just on like the way that Bayonetta's makeup looked. And everyone was like, oh, what's wrong with the artist? And she's like, no, it's how a child would put makeup on. And like, yeah. So credit where credit is due. Casey like knew just from the makeup, which is astonishing to me, but I'm sorry, Mitchell, please go on.
But yeah. And then, you know, the enemies that we're fighting they're homunculus. So that they're unique in that the first two games, all the enemies were basically from Paradiso or Inferno, which is just another way of saying
heaven or hell.
Heaven or heck.
It's a family show.
It's naive.
Yeah. Naive angel mode turned on for this show. So that's interesting because, you know, usually all the threats in Bayonetta have been things that normal people can't see. So it's just like, you know, Bayonetta 2 famously starts with like this airplane that's going out of control. And you're like, what's going on? But Bayonetta is able to see that there are actually monsters on the plane that are, you know, steering it and driving it into the ground. So, you know, you might be able to see some more, you know, actual world reaction to what's going on. I'm so excited for this game. You know, I didn't even need this trailer. I just needed the release date. I cannot wait. As soon as I saw this trailer, I told myself I'm gonna go back and play Bayonetta 2, and I did. I played like 3 hours of Bayonetta 2 before going to bed yesterday.
Nice. And,
you know, turns out that game still rocks.
Yeah, it's a fantastic game. I'm curious as to what role Viola, is that the new character's name?
Mm-hmm.
Powerful, like early 2000s energy just coming out of the Viola character design. So I'm curious, what is her connection with all of this? Or is that not completely unknown?
Yeah, I mean, another one of the things that I think people are you know, toying with the idea of in this is that there's like some sort of multiverse thing going on. So I think there's...
Oh my God, another multiverse, for the love of...
Right?
God.
I think there's theories out there saying that Viola could be like Jean from another universe, because we see Bayonetta from, you know, another universe, and they even say something like Universe Alpha, like they're trying to get back to Universe Alpha or something.
I think they say the Alphaverse, which is actually the same name they use in Everything Everywhere
at
Once.
Oh, the
multiverse movie that just came out this year.
Maybe they got a leaked version of that script.
Yeah, I'm sure it's totally related. That's the crossover we're not expecting.
Bayonetta 3 is crazy enough to totally be canon in the Everything Everywhere All at Once universe.
So true.
But yeah, I think Viola looks awesome, and you know, people are obviously making the connection of how much she kind of looks like Virgil from Devil May Cry.
Mm.
So it's kind of like, you know, Bayonetta's version of Virgil, which you know, hey, every action game could use a version of Virgil, so I'm not complaining.
Sure.
Also, like, one of the abilities that we see Viola use is like this big puppet. That's kind of like the Cheshire doll from Bayonetta 1. So I think that also kind of, you know, lends connection to that, you know, that universe with Cereza.
All right.
Yeah, there it is right there. If you're watching the video, she's got a cool little swinging thing, which, hey, Luca uses that, and so does Jean. So there's all kinds of like plot points that I think people can kind of like craft theories out of, but.
Yes.
I don't know if there's anything really concrete that we can go off right now.
Yeah, and I just want to point out from personal experience, if you have not played Bayonetta, you don't need to understand the story at all. It's just a super fun game with a really weird
story. Do you want to kill giant angels? You can kill giant angels in Bayonetta.
Yeah. It's amazing, and it's so much fun. Kat, I'm curious to hear some of your thoughts about Bayonetta 3 in the new trailer.
It's been under development for what? 4 or 5 years at
100
this point.
Years, actually. Yep.
Yeah, we've been all been waiting.
Originally a Hanafuda card.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the original Bayonetta a lot. It's one of the smoothest and most technically proficient action games out there. I was not extremely invested in the story. All I cared about were the vibes. And it looks like Bayonetta
powerful
3.
Vibes.
So many vibes. I mean, when it's playing Fly Me to the Moon very early in the original game, so good. And then Bayonetta 2. Just ramps it up even higher. I unlocked the Star Fox thing. I love the random Star Fox crossover in Bayonetta 2.
Oh my God, I forgot about that.
Yeah,
and
so
the
good.
Princess Peach stuff too.
Yeah, they had a whole like bunch of crossover outfits for that game that were really, really cool.
I want a Monster Hunter Rise crossover, please, this holiday season. Let's make that happen, because she looks a lot like a longsword user. I'm just saying. And yeah, no, so I think Bayonetta 3 it's always been kind of a niche action game, but highly, highly respected within its individual context. Bayonetta 2 came out on the Wii U, of course, and now they're both available on the Switch. You should go buy them, because they're some of the best games out there. I'm actually pretty hopeful that Bayonetta 3, given a big push from Nintendo and being on a platform with a much bigger install base, will help Bayonetta 3 maybe get a bit more of the notoriety that it deserves.
Mm, yeah, and it's also important to point out, well, it's not important. I think it's interesting that they're releasing a physical version of Bayonetta 1 for $29.99 on Nintendo Switch cartridge, which best believe I'm going to add to my collection and never play, because it just seems like one of those weird collectible games. But Tom, do you think that this is going to be Nintendo's big fall non-Pokemon game, or do you think there's something else in store for us?
Oh, I don't know. It's like, this is the thing about predicting game releases in 2022 feels like a fool's errand now. Like, it just is like you're setting yourself up to be wrong, and I don't know if I want to put myself in that position. Like, it's just so unpredictable. I'm really glad that this game sort of just got a date out of nowhere, right? Because it was one that people have been waiting for so long, and it's one that people have been really excited for. And so the fact that they just like kind of planted this flag that we weren't expecting is just really good, right? Like, I think it's just really cool to have a little bit of stability in there, because Nintendo, to their credit, sometimes they often take a very long time to announce dates, or they wait very late to announce things, but then usually when those dates come down, they stick, right? Which is respectable. And yeah. It's cool to know that, like, we can probably almost certainly rely on this happening and being a nice event in October.
Yeah, I mean, there's no other games releasing on October 28th of mention at all. So
it's worth pointing out that since the release of Bayonetta 2, Bayonetta has been in Smash Brothers. And
that is true. Oh, and
right,
best amiibo of all are the Bayonetta Player 1 and 2. So? Yeah, those are incredible amiibo. They're amazing, but I'm sorry.
She's also one of the most hated characters in Smash Brothers for a while.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because she was super broken in Wii U.
Yeah.
In Smash, the most recent Smash Ultimate, she was actually kind of worthless. So it's a period of extremes for Bayonetta going on. Bad because I really love Bayonetta as a character. You know, I love the design and everything. The glasses, those late 2000s glasses, so pretty. and I would have loved to have mained her in Smash Brothers, but her actual play style in Smash,
while awkward.
It just feels weird, and while I guess faithful to the design, it doesn't feel right to me. Mm-hmm. So never really gelled in Smash, unfortunately.
Yeah, me neither. I'm kind of in the same boat where, like, you know, one of my favorite action game series of all time, but playing her in Smash was just she's so different from every other character in that game. And like the way she comes back, the way she combos, the way she, you know, starts her offense is just so different from everything else that it was hard for me to really get into without devoting just a ton of time to it. So I kind of didn't really bother with it, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, Witch Time stuff just feels weird in Smash. It works perfectly in Bayonetta.
Yeah, I really appreciate her inclusion in Smash Brothers. I think of the announcements of, like, the DLC announcements, she was probably the one that I got most excited for because it was so unexpected. There was rumors that it would happen, but I think very few people actually thought that Nintendo would have, like, a character that's from such a violent and such, like, a sex heavy, you know, action game would actually be part of a game with, like, Isabelle from Animal Crossing or like the villager from Animal Crossing. But yeah, she's such a cool character. Everything you said, Kat, is, like, you know, 100% agree from me.
This year I decided I actually wanted to, like, follow hockey a little bit more than just the most casual of casuals. So I subscribed to a service that streams all of the NHL to your television. The Boston Bruins home opener, I went to watch it, and boom, blackout restrictions apply, which I thought was kind of ridiculous because I'm still 200 miles away from Boston, but whatever. Had I had NordVPN, that wouldn't have been a problem. I would have just gone in, changed my settings to another geographic area, and boom, I could have been watching all the Boston Bruins home games like it was nothing at all. So now I have NordVPN, and I can watch the home games of my local teams streaming without being frustrated. It's the same thing with, like, Netflix. It has all these complicated licensing rules, which from one country to another don't really make sense. So something you could watch on South Korean Netflix, you won't be able to watch on the United States Netflix unless NordVPN, boom, switch to South Korea, and you're watching whatever Korean drama that you want. I highly recommend you do that. I haven't done it myself, but people seem to enjoy them, and who am I to try to bring down people's enjoyment? NordVPN, more than just entertainment and sports availability, it's going to protect you, especially when you're traveling, when you're using public Wi-Fi, people are trying to get in there, they're creeping on you. Bad actors, people trying to steal your password, your bank account details. Who knows what the government's doing these days? I can't keep track. They're all over the damn place. NordVPN, it's going to protect you. It's going to protect up to 6 devices, because I know you have at least that many devices in front of you right now that can hook up to the internet. Boom. Fastest VPN in the world. You're not going to get any buffering. You're not going to get any lagging. It's going to stop your ISP from bandwidth throttling, which they do. That's kind of sneaky, especially how much you're paying those guys. There's threat protection to protect you from viruses and malicious malware and whatever else. Unsavory actors are out there. If you want to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nord.com NordVPN.com/NintendoVC. That's NordVPN.com/NintendoVC. Victor Charlie. That link is also going to give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There is no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nice of them, and I appreciate that.
Here's a quick question for you. How did you sleep last night? If your battle for a good night's sleep feels relentless, I have the answer. It's a podcast called Sleepwave, with meditations and hypnosis created to help you fall asleep. My relaxation techniques will help you feel calm and ready for sleep with soft music that will help you fall asleep in minutes. Most listeners never hear the end of an episode. So search Sleepwave on your favorite podcast app and find out why over 1 million people have fallen asleep to my voice.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Bayonetta is the only character in all of gaming that has gun shoes.
Really?
I think you might be right.
What about Downwell? Doesn't Downwell have
gun shoes? Oh, you're right, Downwell.
I was going to say, there's literally a game made around the concept of gun shoes.
Damn. All right, there's 2 gun shoes. Gun shoe characters. Fine. Still.
I mean, Iron Man technically has gun shoes, kind of. Like, he can shoot little beams of fire out of it.
That is true, but none of them are a match for Kurobu's shoes that allow you to walk over piranha plants and spikes without getting hurt. So there it is. Bayonetta 3 is coming out October 28th. You should play Bayonetta 2 on Nintendo Switch if you haven't, or play it on your Wii U if that's all you have. I was just realizing I've actually not played Bayonetta 2 on my OLED, so I'm really excited to get the just purple.
And the original Bayonetta still holds up. Oh my gosh. It is.
You know what? I never bothered to play it, even though I have it, because obviously it's packed in as a download code with Bayonetta 2 if you buy it on Switch. And I've never played it, so maybe I should do that. Oh, and then there's an 8-bit one that was on Steam for a minute. I don't remember what that was for, but there's an 8-bit Bayonetta out there too.
I don't remember that one either.
Oh yeah, go check it out. It's not that great. It's pretty forgettable. That's probably why you don't know about it. But in terms of surprises and powerful characters, we also got a little glimpse into the continuation of the Year of Kirby, which is unofficial, but it kind of is officially the Year of Kirby. None can stop him. None can stand in his way. Battle not with monsters, lest ye become a monster. It is Kirby's Dream Buffet, which everyone is saying is Kirby Fall Guys. And then Tom is saying, you are way off, Tom. Why is everyone wrong?
We were talking about this before we started recording. It's not Kirby Fall Guys, and it drives me crazy that people are using that shorthand. Like, seriously, it drives me crazy. Because it's like, according to let me start with what it is.
Okay. It's good SEO, Tom. Come on.
It's great. That's SEO.
Yeah.
It's a 4-player party game that is coming. It's going to be part of the Nintendo Expansion Pass. Is that correct?
Or I don't think that was officially confirmed. They haven't confirmed money.
Okay. Maybe right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
then that was just
says coming summer. And
but
yeah,
it should no. Come on.
It feels like the type of game that would, but also on the official site, it doesn't have listed online play yet. So who knows? Okay. Like, why would it be part of the Nintendo Online if it doesn't have online play?
It makes me think of the Mario Battle Royale game. Makes me think of the little multiplayer games that have come out for it.
Right. It's you roll around as a bunch of Kirbys in 4-player around these very sweets covered levels and pick up strawberries and foods and try to get really big so that then you do this like final battle at the end where the size of your Kirby helps you win, basically, is my interpretation of it. The only reason I get mad about the Fall Guys comparison is because like one of the key things about Fall Guys is that you like start with a ton of people and you go through these rounds and it gets whittled down into a single winner or whatever. And this is like, this seems like a very, very different sort of game. It is just sort of like a mini game compilation with a very different sort of thing. So I think the Fall Guys comparisons are misleading in all, but it is a kind of progressive competition between multiplayer competition. And
pastel colored.
That will actually run well on the Switch for one thing.
Oh!
Is that dang. So? But it does look cute.
yes.
I hope
has.
I hope it has online play. I hope the Switch site is just like not listing it right now, because it would be a bummer to have this 4-player focused game require local play would be a drag. And it looks cute. I want to play it with four people, right?
Yeah. Yeah, obviously.
I volunteer to be one of the four that Tom plays it with.
Well, we live in different cities. This is what I'm talking about.
See, that's why Switch is portable. Grab a bus, just head on down.
Nintendo 2022, four players at once online? No one can live at that speed. Oh my God.
It's too dangerous. People could be hurt by it. Also, I wanted to point out that the plural of Kirby is Kirby. So there are up to four Kirby on the screen. And I maybe just made that up, but I think it's official now. So
Harrow's saying
No, I've heard that too.
Okay, perfect.
Harrow was saying that a new Kirby game is always a harbinger of a new console generation or the end of a console generation. So what does it mean that we're getting two in 1 year? Seriously.
Ooh, man.
Oh, well, Kirby, Switch 2.
This is something that we've talked about on the show before, I'm sure, that like Kirby has... It doesn't get a lot of mainline games anymore, but it does just sort of like put out spin-offs all the time, it feels like.
That is true.
Like it had that weird kind of Monster Hunter almost 2D battle game. It had another like fighting game that was on mobile or whatever. Like it just sort of does this occasionally, and it's like a little Kirby treat here and there.
Yeah.
I mean, Kirby is the experimental series. Just feel like, just throw Kirby in there. It's good.
Yeah,
it's apropos of Kirby. It takes on different forms, so...
Yeah, that's true. That's nice.
Oh. Yeah.
What else would you expect from an elder god?
That is true. And now we have four of them at once, which...
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was going to make a joke, and I didn't know where to go with it. And I was like, oh, thank God, Tom is going to say something now that I don't have to go through with a joke I don't have.
Well, the other thing that I do like about this game thematically as like a Kirby fan is one of the things that people really love about like old school Kirby is Gourmet Race, right? That mm-hmm. level where you're racing DDD, picking up lots of foods and that'll get you like higher score or whatever. And this is basically multiplayer Gourmet Race in a weird way, right? Like it's 3D and instead of 2D, but it is a little bit of that sort of, you're literally racing your other people trying to pick up as much food as you can along the way. So I like that this doesn't feel, it doesn't feel like completely out of place for what Kirby does, right? Or has done. And like, if you just pitched this to me as multiplayer Gourmet Race, I would be totally on board.
Maybe if this does well, maybe it's the beginning of a actual Kirby Fall Guys.
Oh,
I think would be pretty sick.
Yeah. Well, you know what'll happen is it'll do really well, and then they'll be like, play it before December 31st because it'll be gone forever, and then we'll never hear about it again.
See, Seth, you just got me because I'm still mourning the death of that Mario Battle Royale game. It was such a good speed running game.
It was so fun.
What are you doing, Nintendo?
Yeah, and there's no way we can ever play that again. And it's such a bummer.
I mean, I'm more of a fan of Tetris 99, but.
Oh, I think they're both great.
Yeah.
It was Tetris 99, right?
Yeah, Tetris 99. And that
is the number.
Right. That game is so intense now. If you try and play it, oh my God.
Yeah, I haven't tried.
Give me Pokemon Puzzle League 99.
Ooh.
That's all I want.
Well, it's available now on Nintendo Switch Online. I mean, if you want to play the old N64 version.
Yep. Yeah.
Is it actually available now or is it available?
Yeah, it just came out today.
Oh man, okay, I know what I'm doing.
I was like, I gotta download this, holy shit.
The second this podcast ends.
All right. I wanted to point out that kudos to Nintendo for hiring, and this is just like Nintendo-wide, I don't think any other video game company in the world makes video game food as appealing as the artists who work at Nintendo across all of their properties. The fruit
Wrong.
Textures.
The Odin Sphere developers do food the best.
Final Fantasy 15 also does a really good job of that.
Yeah.
Okay, those are
Cook Serve Delicious too. Those are.
Listen, I'm talking about publisher wide. Nobody does it better than Nintendo. You look at
you know what? The Yakuza series also does.
Yeah,
does
that's it true. Really...
Do we have a feature about best
hello,
video game
Monster
food
Hunter?
Also,
yeah, Monster Hunter is a good contender. Also, but I think I appreciate what you're saying, Seth, in regards to sweets specifically. Yeah. Nintendo loves cake, and like, man, Nintendo can make a strawberry look so good.
Yeah,
mouth is
oh man,
watering.
Peach's birthday cake in Super Mario Party, or not Mario Party Superstars.
Yeah,
yeah.
Go play. Pick up your 3DS and play Tamagotchi life again and order some food in that. And that is a absolutely delightful food rendering.
Here, Seth, Nintendo has baked a cake for you. Please come to the castle.
Oh, my adventure is about to begin. I'm so excited. I don't know what's in store for me. I just know
a
that
cake,
I'm going to
you say?
How innocent and wonderful. I can't wait to battle through lava pits to kill a giant dragon lizard man.
You'll get that cake eventually.
You know what? That is true. Nintendo always delivers on its promise of cake. So thank you for that, Nintendo. And thanks for making them look so delicious. If you haven't watched the Kirby trailer, absolutely fantastic whipped cream textures. Looks so good. Oh, man. Anyway, enough talking about cake that I can't eat anyway. So we have listened to your concerns, you the listener. And at the end of last week's show, Pear had this idea. He said to me, he said, Seth, why don't you just put question block earlier in the show? And I thought, man, that's a good idea. That must be why he's been working at the same company for 26 years. So we have done that. We have front-loaded question block this week. So we have more than one question block. We have time to answer them, to give them some thought. So I'm going to go through them, starting with Azure Sky asked, have you ever hated a game at first, but loved it on a second try? And I was thinking about this, and I don't have an answer to a game that I hated, but when I first played Red Dead Redemption 2, I thought, this is not a good game. And then I played another hour or two, and I was like on Google looking up where to learn to ride a horse and how to rope cattle. And that ended up being one of my favorite games of all time, like top three. And I didn't like it at all at first. So I'm curious as to the panel's responses to that question. Mitchell, are there any games that you hated at first but then loved once you gave it a second try?
Both hate and love are such strong words.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can't think of any that like fit that exact definition. A recent example that I can probably say is Sock Unleashed. Unleashed is a game that, you know, I kind of fell into the zeitgeist of, and just kind of, like, you know, everyone was talking about how bad Sock Unleashed was at when it first came out. And I played it, really liked the first Sonic level that you play to, and then you get through, like, you know, you kind of slow down through like hub exploration, and then you get the Werehog bit, and you know Sonic Unleashed is a very uneven experience. And I think with like the lens that I was looking at it with, that were kind of painted by the critical reaction, I kind of maybe wrote it off too soon. But recently we were doing a top 10 Sonic game list, and I went back to it. And man, the Sonic levels in this game are so fast, and so, like, the flow of them is so good. I would honestly say it's some of the best 3D Sonic levels I've ever played.
Oh wow!
I went to the Werehog sections with kind of like, you know, a more open view of it, and the Werehog bits are definitely worthy of critique and criticism, but they're not as bad, I think, as a lot of people probably make them out to be. It's just, you know, a simple, you know, beat 'em up with some pretty decent power progression if you invest in the right skills. So I would say Sonic Unleashed, while I didn't hate it and while I still don't love it, that's definitely an example of a game that I kind of wrote off when I first played it and came back to it and found myself, you know, liking it a good amount.
I think that's a perfectly cromulent answer.
Sonic Cat Unleashed, the dawn of the Sonic cycle. I remember the run up to Sonic Unleashed very well, because I was, that was when I first got into press and I interviewed the developers and was like, what's up with the Werehog? Holy cow. And so from then on, the Sonic cycle.
Well, I'm curious as to hear what your answers. And it does, I agree, Mitchell, like hate and love is a little bit strong, but something maybe you weren't feeling, you weren't vibing with, but eventually went on to just like feel great.
Sometimes it just needs a little bit of distance to be able to properly appreciate a thing. And we've had many more Sonic games, some for the worse. So I think it's easier to look at it with a fresher lens. It was very popular to hate on Sonic in 2009, 2010. So I think Sonic Unleashed caught at least some of that. As for me, the game that I didn't like at first, but then grew to love, was the original Metal Gear Solid on PlayStation.
Which, oh, interesting.
A friend of mine loaned it to me when I first got a PlayStation, and I loaded it up and I was in the first section and I was laying on my belly and I was like, what do I do? I don't understand this game. So I just laid on my belly for a while and then I quit and I turned it off and I gave the game back. And I was like, well, that was weird. But everybody was so high in Metal Gear Solid. We're like, no, you got to play it. That I picked it up again at some point. I may have even purchased it. And I started playing it. I got past the first room. I was going up the elevator, had the Metal Gear Solid title appear. Got into that first open section where Solid Snake is like, "Hi D," and I'm like, I'm in on this game. And it
Hi D
is one of the first really good AAA experience, kind of modern AAA experiences that I ever played. I was just absolutely floored by the cinematics and the level design and the stealth gameplay and how excellent the boss battles were. Played it again many times since.
I was going to ask, have you played it recently?
I think the last time I played it was when it came out on PlayStation Network. Some years ago. My impression at the time was that it still held up, but granted, that was also 10 years ago. It's a lot simpler than a modern Metal Gear Solid experience, obviously, and it's more kind of a top-down kind of situation, but I find that charming, actually. Yeah. I find it still works, and the stylized kind of PlayStation graphics are still really cool. I still think it's the best original PlayStation game ever made. But yeah, I will never forget that when I first started playing the original Metal Gear Solid, that I was like, well, I don't understand this game at all. I don't like it. I quit.
That's crazy, because I normally wouldn't have liked a game like that, but I had the opposite. As soon as I started playing, I was like, well, this is the most amazing game ever made. And I have replayed it recently, and it still holds up. It's still very charming. And everyone should play it, and they should port it to Switch along with the rest of them, because it's the 35th anniversary.
Everything on Switch. Let's go.
Everything on Switch. Come on. Let's do it. Come on.
Especially Metal Gear Solid.
But especially Metal Gear Solid. Yeah, man, that would be so good. Well, Tom, do you have any games that you weren't feeling that eventually went on to?
Yeah, I agree with the non, the word hate is too harsh. Like, I've bounced off of plenty of games that I've come back to and enjoyed, right? Maybe a good thing like this is as a series, Monster Hunter, I've tried to get into pre-World and always bounced off it. And then World was the thing that sort of like clicked and then I was obsessed with it. Another one that I think probably is like in a similar camp, although again, it was like I was more just like cold on it and then like set it aside and came back and then got really obsessed, was Warframe.
That's a pretty grindy one, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the it's a very grindy game, but the grind is like kind of the point and the grind is enjoyable, right? Like, that is so much of that game. I haven't played Warframe. I fell off of it a number of years ago. But I have like well over 100 something hours in that game, probably more than that. And like, it is the type of game where once it, like, if you like the loop and it clicks, there is just so much free content in that game that is so fun, and it does not feel like you need to pay a single cent to enjoy any of it. At least when I haven't played in a number of years, but like when I was playing, that was the case. And I know that Digital Extremes, the developer, has like just still been updating it and supporting it all that time. So I kind of like trust that they haven't gone off the rails in a way I wouldn't expect. But yeah, Warframe is a very, very hard game to get into. But once you just sort of like get over that hump and start enjoying it, it is really a cool time.
Yeah, I'm curious as to what percentage of PS4 owners' first game was Warframe, because it was free and available on day one. So I would say probably like 98% of PlayStation 4.
It was quite bad when it first came out, though.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
If you've only played Warframe at PS4 launch, it is essentially like not, like, think of it not like Warframe. It's like Warframe 3 at this point. Like, the amount of times that they've just like reinvented it, it's a totally different game.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Destiny is also very much like that. Destiny, you know, while I wouldn't say I hated Destiny when it first came out, but Destiny like made me feel like I was wasting my time with it when it first came out, just because of the way that the mechanics were structured. But over the course of, you know, the however many years Destiny's been around, they've iterated upon it so many times with like drastic iterations it's gotten to a point where I think Destiny 2 is honestly one of the best shooters around right now.
Really?
Yeah.
Mitch take.
I will.
I mean, I don't even think it's a hot take to say that, like, mechanically, Destiny 2, like, feels better than almost any other shooter that I've ever played, just in terms of the way the guns feel, the way, like, the enemy AI react to how you, like, you know, approach them. It's such a mechanically solid game.
Yeah.
And well,
that's a big part of what Bungie's known for, right? Is those gun mechanics.
Yeah. And like just the way all the guns feel different from each other and how like the exotic weapons truly feel special. And like are honestly game changing in terms of how they affect your playstyle. Destiny already gets a lot of respect. It gets a lot of hate. But if you ever like, you know, if you ever like pass judgment on Destiny back when, you know, it first came out, I think you should give it another shot.
Yeah.
Even though it's a very hard game to jump into now because most of the starting story content has been vaulted. So like it's hard to get people on board with Destiny from like a story perspective, and it's a little overwhelming at first, but if you got like a good person to guide you through it, highly recommend getting into Destiny 2.
Yeah, and it's got one of the most powerful SEO terms, where is Xur? So little SEO humor for you there. All right, that is our first, and now we have another question. We're on a roll here. A new record, question two. This is sort of the same question from two different people, Zachary McDaniel and Dylan Maxwell Graham. How do you balance work and play in terms of video games? I assume staying up to date and partaking in the moment-to-moment zeitgeist necessitates playing almost everything, but how does one do that and avoid gaming burnout and continue enjoying games as a hobby? And Dylan's question was, does getting this podcast together or reviewing games ever feel like real work? And I think this is a question that a lot of people have. Does playing video games professionally make you dislike video games? And I'm, or not dislike, but does it feel like work? And I'm curious as to, I'm going to ask Mitchell, because you probably are playing a video game right now while you're also talking, because that's just how good you are at video games. So I'm curious if you could speak to this question first.
I feel very fortunate in that I've never had that feeling of burnout in all the times that I've done this. I feel like if I did, then, you know, I would start looking elsewhere for work, because there's a lot of really great things about working in games journalism. There are also a lot of things that are, you know, not so great. You know, there are definitely opportunities that I think I've probably passed up to, you know, have a life where I make a lot more money and have like a more comfortable living situation. But you know, I've always kept with this because I genuinely love playing video games and talking about video games and critiquing video games. So I feel like I've been fortunate in that I haven't gotten to that point. I still love E3. I still love, you know, I still get the excitement of getting a code for a game that I'm looking forward to review. I think, you know, key to that has definitely been, you know, having my wife to keep me sane, keep me, you know, into other things other than just playing video games. I watch a lot of anime, you know, I watch a lot of TV shows.
Well, hold on. That's actually another question. Don't tell us. Shh.
Sorry.
We'll get it. Ahead.
Oh my gosh.
But yeah, no, I don't know what I do to avoid it, but it hasn't really hit me in the years that I've done this.
All right, cool. Kat, what about you?
I think that I've managed to stay up and interested in video games. I think the Switch has been kind of instrumental in that in some ways, because it's been a high-end gaming experience that's also portable. And so one of the big things with games for me is that it takes me away from my family, and I want to go spend time with the rest of the people in my household. So I'll be like, but how can I do that if I'm just sitting there playing video games? So having the Switch with me and being able to play on the couch while we're all like watching a show or something, especially like in RPG, for example, that's how I ended up playing a lot of Animal Crossing, a lot of Bravely Default 2 and whatnot. I was able to kind of enjoy the best of both worlds. I still get really, really excited when I find a game that genuinely hooks into my brain. That thrill of it discovery is what keeps me going. I think if, when you're in the games industry, one of the things you'll quickly discover is you have your blind spots. Like a lot of people are like, oh, I know this game intimately. Why doesn't this game journalist know this game intimately? Well, I think we all have our blind spots, but we also have our strengths. And one of the cool things about being in this business is that I've been able to discover so many games that I would never have picked up in a million years if I hadn't actually been in the games media, like Battlefield, for example. I never would have picked up Battlefield. And I actually ended up really enjoying the series until it kind of got driven into the ground. same with various sports games and whatnot. And I think that kind of that opportunity to go outside my comfort zone as I'm trying all of these different games and being able to try out games that are being recommended to me is one of the things that I find most gratifying about this job.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And what about you?
Well, to that end, I will also say for part of Zachary, I think it is question of keeping up necessitates playing almost everything. No one can do that. And no one is expected
especially
to do that.
Especially not now with a fire hose of content.
Yeah. And like you have to pick your battles, and you obviously we want to stay informed of everything. But to Kat's point, one of the things that is great about working in a company like IGN is like, I know I don't have to play and be up to date on every fighting game because we have people like Mitchell and we have people like Ronnie who like they love those things and they can cover them so much better than I ever could. So it's not worth me trying to like wade into that when I don't really enjoy that genre very much. Right. And so that I think helps is like knowing what you enjoy. And then to Dylan's point about like, does it ever feel like work? Like, yes. It's just because you enjoy it doesn't mean it's also not like actual work. I think something that people who look at games media and think like, oh, I'd love to review games, sometimes don't think about, and I'm not saying not everyone does this, I'm just sometimes some people don't think about, is that to make reviewing games your career, you have to not like, just liking games isn't enough. You have to enjoy the work around the game playing too. Like, yeah. I really love writing, right?
Yeah.
Like, it is a passion of mine to write reviews, and that is not as fun as playing the video game. It is the work part, but I also enjoy that part. So I haven't actually, like, burned out on that yet. And so I think that is a big part of it, is that, like, for me at least, like, I enjoy all of the aspects of this job, including the work parts, because there are lots, like the vast majority of the job is not playing, just sitting there playing games, right?
Yeah.
So yeah.
In terms of balancing things, I think one of the things I've had to do is bounce off live service games, because on the one hand, it's really beneficial to be able to say, okay, I'm super up on this particular service game. Like for example, for me, it was like FIFA or whatever. But I ended up having to bounce off them because there comes a point where it's like, okay, I put like 500 to 1,000 hours into this game and it's making it so I can't easily pick up other experiences that I'm missing out, and I want to be able to talk intelligently about a wide variety of games. So for me, it's become as much about breadth as anything, because so many of these games now are just giant treadmills where you're just grinding and grinding and grinding and unlocking things. And there comes a point where I can't do that anymore. So that's one of the things that I've ended up dropping in recent years is these live service games.
Yeah, I think that's also a reason why live service games are such like a hard thing to cover at a place like IGN. Sometimes I think we literally just hired a person on guides to focus directly on live service games. But it is because of the fact that, you know, they're constantly evolving, and you can't just have someone jump into it to cover the most recent update in it. You have to have someone who has been, you know, building up their skill set or their character or whatever to be able to properly cover that new content. And it's a challenge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Embedded in the community. They know all the influencers. They know what the discourse is. around a particular game. That's how you cover a live service game effectively. And yeah, you're right. Like finding people with expertise in, say, Fortnite or Genshin Impact or Minecraft, they're worth their weight in gold in this business.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to give my own thoughts on the balance of work, play, and play. As far as me, I am probably the worst at work play. Like, I play games for work if I'm reviewing them, but I don't necessarily play a game that's maybe in the zeitgeist unless I really want to. Like, when Call of Duty comes out, like, look, me and my friends, we play Call of Duty every year. It's just like what we do. And I'll play it, but not because I want to talk about it on podcast, but because I like it. And also the bonus is if I get invited onto Beyond or Unlocked or something, I can talk about Call of Duty, or I might kill two birds with one stone and also review it. But yeah, as far as like reviewing games feeling like real work, for me, that has never been the case, with the exception of Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles Remake, which I gave a 3.5 because I hated it. Okay. So much.
You're telling me that the moment when you're up at 3 a.m. because you're on deadline and you got to capture more scenes so that you can go and get that script ready, that doesn't feel like work to you?
Okay, that feels a little worky.
Yeah, Mitchell, what was the you and me each, we both played what, like 35 hours of Final Fantasy VII Remake in 3 days, 2.5
hours. Oh, okay. I have
that
been.
That was work.
I have been fortunate enough that I've never.
I had a great time. I love that game.
I mean, the game was great. It was a lot of fun. But also, that was like, okay, I need a vacation.
Yeah,
now.
I'll say I've been fortunate enough where I haven't had to turn like huge games around like that quickly. But I did, you know, Octopath Traveler. I think we got that like the code like a week before deadline. And now, like, you know, Dan and Tom, bless your hearts, now you're not so hung up on like if a game is huge and we get the code 3 days beforehand, you're not like, well, we need to put this. It's like it's more important.
Yeah,
to be
fully clear, like that the something like the Final Fantasy thing is not like encouraged, and it's not the norm, and it shouldn't be.
Right,
right?
It's
like all
what
that
you want to do. Like nobody's stopping either one of you from playing a game that you're really enjoying.
Right. Dan Stapleton, our reviews editor, will be like, "Look, if you can't make deadline, can't make deadline." We're IGN.com. Like, we'll get the review up. So there is an element of like, for God's sake, don't burn yourself out. But
yeah.
I think there's also sometimes you just want to make it work, you know? So
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a point of pride in doing something like that, of like being able to turn something like that around. But it is not anything that should be encouraged necessarily. And it's thankfully, this is a total tangent now, but like it does feel like it's not always like. One of the things, I'll say this much, one of the things I love about Nintendo, and this is not always, but, like, Nintendo's generally pretty dang good about getting code with a lot, like, a lot of time to play, right? Like, they are, and that's not always, right? Like, there's always exceptions to everything, but, like, Nintendo is usually thinking about that stuff, it seems like, at least from our perspective. I don't know for sure, obviously, but
yeah.
As opposed to day-and-day codes where you're just like, well, it's a race now. It would be nice if Nintendo gave out more codes. More codes, Nintendo.
Just give everybody some codes as a treat. I will say reviewing games is my favorite part of working here, absolutely bar none. Like I love reviewing games, and I haven't reviewed anything in forever, and it's driving me crazy. It's just because I haven't had the time, and there just really hasn't been anything.
Quiet ear.
I'm here with two reviewers, but my experience of reviewing games is that it can actually sour me on a game a little bit, because I was also reviewing Final Fantasy VII Remake. And those dungeons are so long that because I wasn't pacing myself, I really felt the pacing issues in that game to the point where I'm like, I just don't enjoy it as much. I feel like I'm really too focused on this particular aspect of a game, where I feel like if I had been taking it more at my own pace, that wouldn't have affected me as much.
I have something similar that happens with me, is where I will play a game and I will love it for review and I will love every second of it. And as soon as like my review hits the front page, I'm like, well, I'm never playing that game again, because I just don't want to. And
You need a little bit. I often need a little bit of a break like that. And Kat, the thing you mentioned is definitely an unfortunate reality. It's just like, for me, it's one of those biases that you just kind of gotta like always have in the back of your head, of like, how would somebody actually be playing this game, right? Like it's something I think about also with like roguelikes. Like I haven't reviewed, I don't know if I've reviewed a roguelike, but roguelike reviews are interesting because when you get a game, you know, a week and a half before it comes out and you have a week and a half to beat this roguelike, like most people are going to be playing this roguelike over months, right? And that's sort of a different vibe to it. So it doesn't like discredit a review in that. It's just something that a reviewer needs to be aware of, I think.
Yeah, I mean, reviewing Elden Ring, I definitely had moments.
Still in awe of you.
Definitely have had moments where, you know, it's like late at night and I'm fighting the same boss for like an hour and I die again and I'm like, I hate this game. Like, you know, put the controller down. But you know, I'm on a deadline, so like I want to keep going through it. Normally, if I was at that moment, I would take a break and, you know, come back to it, you know, with fresh eyes. But when you're kind of on that review kick, you know, you kind of want to push yourself through it. And that is one of the things that I had to be like, okay, I may have said that I hate this game right now, but, you know, if I was playing this game normally, I would put the controller down, I would do something else, I would come back, I would beat the boss, and it would be, I would get that amazing rush of, like, you know, adrenaline, like, yes, I finally did it, and I would be happy.
Yeah.
So it is just kind of a matter of like Tom said, keeping that bias in the back of your mind and understanding that things would be different if circumstances were different.
Yeah. One thing in... this comes, I think, for me with experience, is when I was first doing reviews, I was so terrified that I was going to be wrong, that my opinion was going to be the wrong opinion and I would be eviscerated. And now that I've done enough reviews, I have enough confidence. I'm like, well, and I know that a review ultimately is just like the opinion of the reviewer. And Tom and Dan work very hard to make sure that the person reviewing the game matches that sort of game. Like, I did Flight Simulator because I did the preview and I loved it. And it turns out I'm a huge simulator nerd now and I love all those stupid sim games. But yeah, I don't know if that is any of your experiences, but when I first started, I was like, oh my God, what if this review is wrong and everyone hates me online? And now I don't care.
Oh no, I'm a giant contrarian.
Okay.
If I'm like super high in a game, but other people like it or don't like it, I'll be like, no, I'm going to defend this game to the death.
Nice.
I tried to take their critiques seriously though and like look at it with open eyes, but I think that it's actually really important, and I think everybody would agree that we have kind of a range of opinions, and I think that the Metacritic scoreboard watching is quite toxic on a lot of
it doesn't help
publications.
Anybody.
Yeah
if a review is somebody's interpretation or opinions of on a game, there's like the only way it can be incorrect is if it has like factual errors in it, right? Like how someone enjoyed something can't be wrong. It is just how they felt about it.
Yeah. So
it was absurd to watch the Cyberpunk discourse in real time where you had the people who were very high on it at first, but then a couple people who were not high on it and they were getting attacked. But then everybody picked up Cyberpunk, started playing it, and then the discourse flipped, and now the people who liked it were getting attacked. And you're just like, it's very exhausting.
Yeah, you still can't even be like, I played Cyberpunk without 100 people telling you how
some of these games
you
just know when you're playing it, you start getting a sinking feeling of like, uh-oh.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Is this going to be a game?
Yeah. I will say I had the exact opposite when I was reviewing Flight Simulator. I had this like a magic feeling. I'm like, oh, this is a 10. I'm going to give this a 10. This is a masterpiece of a game. That was pretty cool to be able to play that before anybody else, which is the whole reason I got into this industry.
Gratifying feeling to be like, this game's amazing. I love this game. This is so good. And you just pray that it sticks to landing so that you can really praise it a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. And God bless Microsoft Flight Simulator. Still getting better, but enough about those questions. Chris Baker, this is why I had to stop Mitchell. Chris Baker asks, can everyone share a hobby or activity that they are most passionate about outside of video games in the industry as a whole? And I mean, you already know that I love old vintage computers and electronics, and I like messing around with those and playing with them, which reminds me, oh no, I was going to be my, what we've been playing, but I got a a Wi-Fi serial modem adapter for my 1984 K Pro 2. So I'm going to be able to telnet into my Linux computer and surf the internet through links on a computer that was built before the World Wide Web standard was even being considered, which is, that's why I'm in my basement all the time. Other than that, I really love bass fishing. So Mitchell, what about you? You said you like watching anime, but what else?
Yeah, I'm a big anime fan. I recently got into disc golf, which has been, during the pandemic, it was just kind of like one of those really good activities that was, you know,
outside away from people.
You don't have to deal with anyone. It's something that you can do by yourself. It's cheap to get into. Literally just buy like a $20 thing of three discs and go to a park and you're good. So that's been something that's been really good for me. And TV shows, that's always been a good thing. Things that I can do with my wife that we both enjoy, are always positive.
Nice.
But yeah, that's kind of it. Video games is definitely the big one.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that goes without saying, but Kat, what about you?
In the before times, I really enjoy traveling. I've been to about 20 countries at this point.
Wow.
I would like to go to more countries again, but we'll see if that ever happens. I've been doing more active activities lately, like biking. I'm doing Give Hockey a Try Day next month. Yeah, so I'm going to see if I can still skate. It's been a long time since I've actually
It's just like riding skates. A bike.
I know,
legs.
Seriously.
And I miss ice skating.
Yeah, I miss traveling. I want to do it again. And I'm also a big sports fan. And I think I've kind of alluded to that. I especially love soccer, hockey, baseball, and football, and follow them all quite avidly. In fact, I'm missing the women's Euros as we speak while this episode is being recorded.
I don't know what that is. So
there's a tournament happening in Europe right now between England and Germany and France, various European countries, but it's the women's teams. And so it's
That's why Pear isn't here today. Okay. He said he had a meeting.
Let's go Holland.
Tom, what about you? What are your hobbies outside of gaming? What are you passionate about?
Well, my hobbies outside of video games is a cop-out because it's Magic the Gathering, which technically isn't a video
come on
game.
Now. That's just a video game analog version.
I mean, gaming. The gaming section.
Magic the Gathering came out in 93, so it's been around just as long, right? You know what I mean. I play a lot of that, and I do a lot of that stuff.
That
and
counts,
then,
by the way. I was just
Josh. Honestly, I'm pretty boring. Like, I enjoy biking, and I do the occasional little bit of gardening here and there, or the occasional little bit of cooking here and there that I enjoy, but like, I just try to find little things, TV, but honestly, beyond playing games and doing magic stuff, I don't have a lot of other hobbies.
And you mean Magic the Gathering, not summoning spells and arcane?
Well, that too. I think probably if anything, I love a good bike ride.
Yeah. Hey, you all have me thinking I want to get a bicycle. They're so expensive, though, if you get
a
good one.
I've been commuting into work lately on my bike. It's been great.
You don't need a good bike to go biking.
I know, but I tend to front load a lot of money into my hobbies that I eventually abandon. So look at my oscilloscope back there. That'll surely give me years of pleasure.
Yeah, I'm thinking about getting back into streaming, and I'm like, well, how much gear do I need to buy? Uh-oh, this is going to get expensive fast.
You just reminded me, one of the things that I love, and I don't do it nearly as much, is photography, and I have a few thousand dollars worth of lenses, like, that I don't take the care that they deserve of, because I am the worst person. But yeah, photography.
So Mitchell actually inspired me to pick up Japanese again, and I'm on Duolingo, because he was saying that he was on this giant streak, and I'm like, I bet I could do that, so... Nice. They really gamify learning how to speak.
Yes,
Japanese.
It's fun. Duolingo's great.
I fell off my German, and now I'm going to pick it up again. I was just like, I'm never going to Germany. Why am I bothering?
Take it to Gamescom, and we can do an NBC.
Yeah. Oh my God. That would be so wonderful. I don't know the German alphabet though, so I can't say what it would actually be. And
we see in Deutschland. Let's go.
In Deutschland. Wie geht es Ihnen, mein Suppen Freundens? A Zupa pair would be very mad. He got so mad because I said my tea is Su Heiss. And he's like, Su, what does that mean? No, you're wrong. It's Zu. Like, oh, okay. I'm sorry. Next question is from Gregory Moorhead. The new Lego Bowser looks amazing. What Nintendo Lego set would you most like to see happen? And this is a no-brainer for me. So I'm gonna like just see what everyone else has to say first. If anyone have anything that springs immediately to mind?
Yes.
Zelda?
Oh, that's where I was going with it. The Hyrule
I'm not
Castle?
A big Lego person, but I think
Have you seen that Bowser? So cool.
Yeah. I haven't seen it, actually.
Oh my God, it's ridiculous. It's like $230 or something, and it's fantastic. But yeah, the Lego Nintendo sets are just fantastic, and they're wonderful, and it makes so much sense. But yeah, I want to see Hyrule Castle.
How about a Lego set of Samus's scout ship?
Ooh, that would be amazing. Yes.
And you could put a little Lego Samus, and I think Samus would fit well as a Lego because you could put the helmet on and everything. And you can put her inside the actual, you could open up the cockpit and put her inside there.
Yes. And a little one-peg Metroid that follows her around.
Oh, yeah. No, there you go. Yeah, you put it on top of the ship.
God, I love that so much. Tom, do you have any suggestions or dreams?
I hadn't seen this question before. And for some reason, the very first thing that popped into my head, and I now actually just genuinely want, is a Lego set of Yoster Isle from Super Mario RPG Legend of the Seven Stars, which is the little like Yoshi racing course level that you can find. I don't know why. I want that, but how great would it be to have a little Yoshi race course with little different colored
Yoshi?
Yeah, a little Boshi, yeah. I think that would be great.
I love it.
I think the island from Wind Waker in the style of the Wind Waker Switch version.
That would also be wonderful.
Would fit perfectly for Lego.
Which island? Just the outset?
With the windfish egg and everything. So
Just
get a whole set. Whole set. It's just a whole island.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah, Nintendo make more Lego sets, or Lego make more Nintendo sets. I don't know. I don't know who we need to send our letters to. All right. One last question before we move on, because I actually lingered too long on question block. And now we have to go through the next
segment. We get
all
the question block this time.
We get them all. Adrian House wants to know, what is your earliest video game memory? I was like 4 years old and I saw someone playing Atari 2600 Pac-Man on a black and white TV. So that should tell you how old I am. And that is to say, I am very old. And I don't know why I remember that specifically, but I do. And I remember that was it. It was on. I needed to do this all the time. Put it into my life. So, what are your earliest video gaming memories?
It's nothing specific, but I definitely remember playing a lot of Mega Man 3 when I was a little kid. And it's funny because I actually, on Twitter, I've been going through a bunch of VHS tapes and digitizing them. And I found the Hanukkah where I got Mega Man 3, and I digitized it. I put it on Twitter. It's literally just me opening a present and like holding up. Look what I got Mega Man 3.
Aww.
It's super cute.
Oh man.
And then his gaming journey began.
Yeah.
Exactly.
What a great, that was actually the first game that I ever bought with my own money. So that's really cool. Kat, what's your earliest gaming memory?
Oh, this is definitely going to date me, but so my dad actually liked video games and he had an Atari 5200. And there is a picture of me as a tiny baby looking up at the TV and being very excited about it. But the earliest memory that I have is of trying to play Star Raiders, which is this game, quite famous game for the Atari, in which you're flying around in a spaceship and, you know, blowing up star bases and whatnot and fighting enemies. And it's kind of first person. It's actually quite impressive for an Atari game. And I had no idea what I was doing, but I did really enjoy flying around in that spaceship. So every time I finished killing the enemies, I would go to my dad and be like, what do I do next? And then he would send me to the next sector with more spaceships to shoot at. I'm like, all right, perfect. So
that's awesome.
That's my formative video game memory is playing
Star
Raiders. Was it
a joystick or was it a paddle controller?
It was an Atari 5200. So you had this horrible remote control thing with this very squishy joystick you would slide into a kind of a dock thing. And it was this very simple and early version of a dual analog stick setup that you could play certain games with. Those joysticks were absolutely horrible. And the Atari 5200 failed miserably.
Yes, it did. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the Atari 5200, you can tell that it was a bad system because literally no one has nostalgia for the Atari 5200.
Wrong. I do, because we had one.
Okay, that's different. All right. No one but Kat, because of this one very special case, because it's a meaningful childhood memory. But other than that, nobody liked
it. Giant contrarian.
Totally on brand. Tom, what's your earliest gaming memory?
I think I've talked about this on the show before. It was watching my mom play Myst when I was 2 or 3 years old.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I just...
From the makers of Cosmic Osmo.
Yeah, she liked Myst, and she liked... once we got it later, she was into Link to the Past. I just remember...
Oh, that's awesome.
She was the one who put me on that track. Even though she doesn't like video games now at all, she just like was... into that sort of stuff. She was a beta tester for Uru, which was the Myst online MMO that they made.
What?
At one point. Oh, yeah. She was super into Myst. That got me into this.
Incredible.
So there you go.
Oh, wow. I had no idea there was a Myst MMO.
Yeah, it was a wild idea. Very strange idea, but.
Yeah, because it's a point and click like puzzle game, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So you had an avatar and there were like little instance worlds you could go out to with other people and solve puzzles, and this was early,
kinda
so
cool,
like
cool actually
people, you know, there
collaborative puzzle
like,
solving, right?
Yeah
so there wasn't just like a strategy guide the day the game came out that solved everything for everyone, so it was like this it was a lot of it lived in forums of people trying to piece together these puzzles together.
Wow, that is fascinating. Actually, I need to look up this.
So wait, is there a modern game that's like this? That's like a massively online puzzle game? Because if there hasn't, why aren't we doing this? This is, sounds like a brilliant idea. It's going to do so well.
Yeah.
I think a fan community brought back Uru in some fashion, but I don't know otherwise.
Be right back. I'm going to go get a pitch doc started so I can go be rich.
Okay. Okay, Kat's back. No, that wasn't a real break. Only
hello, everybody.
All right. That was Question Block. Thank you, everyone, for submitting your questions. We're going to be front loading Question Block from now on. And if you're counting how many times I said front loading, that's 8 now. Now we're going to talk real quick about what we've been playing. I got Pocky and Rocky Reshrine finally, the physical version. I haven't opened it yet, and I don't know if I'm going to because I know it's a rare game. And I don't know if I want to. I want to break the seal, but Pear is going to be mad at me, so I'll play it this week when I have time off. So, Kat, you have exciting updates to your Nuzlocke run.
Oh, yeah. So over the weekend, I did a revenge run to try and get to Morty, and I did it about 4 hours, and I got started out with Totodile. I was very stressed out heading into Whitney, because Whitney is famously kind of a big block in Pokemon Crystal with her Miltank. So I was just sweating and sweating. It was like, how am I going to get past this? All I have is a Pidgeotto and a Totodile. Thankfully, I was able to use accuracy hacks and be able to just lower its accuracy to basically 0%, which allowed me to take it out easily. And then my Feraligatr just ate all of Morty's Gengars. So it ended up working out really well. But it was a really fun experience. I'm really glad I got to do it. So my Nuzlocke run... which, if you're not familiar with the concept of a Nuzlocke run, it's you have permadeath in your Pokemon, is what it basically boils down to. And there are a handful of other rules, but it's a challenge run. And I've never done a proper Nuzlocke run, but my last one ended quite embarrassingly because I died to Morty. So I didn't have enough awakenings, but now I'm back on track. I think I can get it. I can beat Ash. So that's my big Nuzlocke run update.
Excellent. That should be a new segment right now. Tom, what have you been playing?
So I've been playing a thing for review I can't talk about yet, mostly. Then, obviously, I came off of the Sunbreak review, which I enjoyed quite a bit.
Right, which is, I asked you on so you could talk about Sunbreak, and then I completely flub the time, so I apologize for that.
Well, if it helps, like, I'm kind of waiting on updates for that, because part of the funny thing about reviewing a Monster Hunter game is that you've done all of the content when it comes out.
Oh yeah.
So there's just like I'm waiting for the first title update to kind of go back to it.
How many hours did it take you to get through Sunbreak?
Just beating the story, like rolling credits, took me like 20 hours.
Okay.
And then I think I played, by time of the review published, I think I played about 50.
Yeah, I've been playing with my group. We just got started. I'm up to the Blood Orange Bishoten. And I had super end game gear at mm-hmm. high rank, so I haven't really felt the need to upgrade my gear yet. I know that's going to be coming sooner or later, but it's been very front loaded with monsters that you have already fought. And it makes me think of a Simpsons quote. It's just like, no, you're going to fight the monsters in different colors again, again, and again, and again.
And so, again.
Yeah,
that's Monster Hunter Rise. But I mean, it's so much fun to play with your friends. So I'm just like, whatever, it's fine.
Yeah, it's definitely front loaded with kind of a lot of the non-new stuff. They make you wait a bit. But mm-hmm. also, that didn't feel like a huge like point to me overall, because like, you know, if they make you wait 15 hours to get to like a lot of the new stuff, then you play 100 after that, right? Like the vast majority of the time you have access to everything in a game like that. So like overall, I think it smooths out, right?
I haven't been using the new mechanics too much. Like there's the new switch skills. Admittedly, I'm using the switch axe, but I'm like, well, I already have I know what silk bind skills I already like. I like the one where I'm shooting into the air and then diving. That's part of my overall combo set anyway. So I haven't felt a lot of impetus to change. I don't know if that's the case with other weapons where you maybe feel a little more impetus to do that.
I'm an insect glaive main, and I had one switch skill that I liked in specific situations. So I was really nice to be able to swap to that in those exact situations. It was basically like a good skill to wake up monsters, which the insect glaive never really had before. But yeah, besides that, I didn't go like crazy with it or anything. It's a cool thing though, because it basically just expands your moveset, and more choice like that is never a bad thing for people who really want to engage with it.
It's wild to go back to this game after playing Elden Ring, because it feels like the monsters are moving in slow motion now.
Yeah.
All right.
I bet.
Well, Mitchell, you said you've been playing Bayonetta 2. What else you been up to real quick?
Yeah, I feel like we already talked about all the games that I'm currently playing. I'm also playing the game that Tom can't talk about for because he's reviewing it.
Is that what are you two, like, you use your fusion powers when you review games?
They're Voltroning up.
you know how Twitter just rolled out, like, co-tweets or whatever? We're doing co-reviews now.
Oh, wow.
That won't confuse anybody or be problematic in any way.
Yeah, video review just call them boyfriend reviews. One word at a time.
That's perfect, because for Xenoblade 3, you can Ouroboros for the review, where you both turn into like a giant.
I've also been playing Eye of the Somnium Files Nirvana Initiative, the sequel to the first Eye of the Somnium Files, which is really good. I just beat it a couple days ago, and not quite as good as the first game, but still a very good detective mystery novel that's just off the rails insane.
Wait, is that... Is that title I, not AI?
I, yes, I.
I
really? No.
It's like a pun that works on like a number of different levels.
Okay. I just had no idea. I just always assumed it was AI.
No, it's I, the Somnium Files. Yeah, cool. One of the main characters is an AI. Her name is Iba. She's an eyeball. It's just like I said, it's a pun that works on a number of levels.
Cool.
It just keeps on going.
At least love two.
It. Yeah.
Man, I like that a lot. Now I might have to check this out. This is on Switch.
Everyone should really check it out. If you haven't even heard of Eye of the Somnium Files, definitely check it out.
What is it? Is it like a visual novel, or is it?
It's a visual novel. It's a murder mystery where basically the whole thing is that you dive into the psyche of different people who are close to the case to find out what they're hiding. And like, so you kind of dive into like a dreamland where nothing really follows the normal rules, and you can like make your avatar do like weird things, like, you know, inspect that umbrella, and then it's like, okay, what do you want me to do with it? Put it on your head. It's like, okay, why am I doing this again? So it's just, you can do a bunch of really weird things that ultimately lead you to like going further into the dream.
I'm gonna have to check this out. This looks, just from the graphics alone, I'm like, oh, this is absolutely my aesthetic.
It's really good.
I'm gonna have to check it out. All right, cool. Well, that is what we've been playing. Remember, you can always head to ign.com/playlist, create your own personal playlist and more. You can do like I did, where I put every game that I ever reviewed for IGN into a playlist to serve the needs of my own ego. But that is all the time we have this week on Nintendo Voice Chat. We have a special guest host next week because I'm going on vacation, and I will see you all.
I'm going to be at San Diego Comic-Con.
Yeah, who could it be?
I'm also going to be at San Diego Comic-Con.
And I am not.
I'm going to be in Bellevue for a Magic the Gathering convention.
Oh, nice. Oh, man, that sounds fun as hell. Well, I'm just not going to be here on the show, but you can follow us on Twitter at NVC Podcast. You can submit your question block questions to the NVC Facebook group, and we're going to be better about answering them. I want to thank Red on the ones and the twos. I want to thank Mitchell and Tom for being our guests this week. Most of all, I want to thank you, the audience, for listening. Remember, NVC is the only place where you can
get the thing.
Get the thing.
Get that thing.
Hi, I'm Alexis Ohanian. You may know me as one of the co-founders of Reddit, but more recently, a large part of my identity is being a father to my two wonderful daughters. In my podcast, Business Dad, I'm hoping to open up the conversation about balancing careers and family. The one thing I constantly hear successful people say, without fail, is that they wish they'd spent more time with their kids. That's time no one can get back. So I decided to create Business Dad, to engage in the conversation about how we're spending our time now, providing a forum for successful dads to share their joys and challenges of being a working parent. You'll get to hear from a wide range of business dads, from Rainn Wilson and Guy Raz to Todd Carmichael and Shane Battier. And while this podcast will talk about business and will definitely be featuring dads, I think everyone can learn something from these incredible conversations as we unpack the expectations we all have about careers, relationships, and ourselves. Business Dad is available now, so be sure to listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.